Book of the Week with Claire Armistead on guardian.co.uk.
When did you last set foot in a library? Me? Probably the time I sidled in to return all those overdue animal art books that my daughter quite suddenly grew out of and therefore forgot to return. In the week that Public Lending Right reveals which are the most borrowed authors and titles over the last year, we look at what this chart says about the book borrowing public with best-selling author Tracy Chevalier. We'll also be looking through the most borrowed books with the booksellers Benedicta Page. We'll be talking to Peter Carey about his new novel Parrot and Olivier in America. And to whet your appetite for that, here he is reading a passage for the book. In this scene, Olivier is interrogating Parrot about the making of art in democracy. But Parrot is thinking about something quite different, his time spent in Australia.
Olivier says, do you think there may be in any case a problem with art in a democracy? Democracy? Jesus! Excuse me, sir. You cannot call a jail a democracy. It was a dictatorship, a cruel one too. They do not transport a man for showing at the Royal Academy. His glass was full, but he filled mine first. The lantern had begun to sway. Very well, I said, speaking as if to an equal. But did you not observe the paintings on the walls of Philadelphia? They made me think that the taste for ideal beauty and the pleasure of seeing it depicted can never be as intense or widespread among a democratic as compared to an aristocratic people. So you look at art, then? He asked, and for a nasty moment I thought he was sneering at me. You own a canvas or two yourself, I suppose. I was privileged to be born in a house of art. Great painters, sir, hanging everywhere you looked. Indeed, I said, and wondered if this weight or wealth and culture pained him. Turner's father was a barber, he said plainly, a plain old barber with a wart on his nose. Turner? An English painter, sir. Where did that thought come from, I asked, amused by the wart as much as anything. He tapped his forehead with his glass. You are correct, he said. You are correct, it is a privilege. I had a house in Woollahra, he offered, rolling his tongue around the savage name. At night time people came to be painted. As a result of Mrs. Patterson's book, I had too much attachment to certain effects, but I was popular just the same. I was embarrassed by the enormity of his misunderstanding. He stared at me, then drained the glass and held it beneath the swaying lantern, studying a tear of alcohol as it rolled along below the brim. With brandy, he said, there's always one last drop. Warily, I raised my glass. And you, he said to me directly, who are you?
Peter Carey, reading from Parrot and Olivier. There'll be more from him later. First, though, libraries. Earlier this week, Sarah Crown went over to Swiss Cottage Library to meet Tracy Chevalier among the fiction shelves, just downwind from science fiction. Tracy sits on the Public Lending Right board, and Sarah began by asking her what that involved.
We meet a couple times a year and keep track of what's going on with the Public Lending Right. The Public Lending Right is this really elegant piece of legislation formed in 1979, which gives authors the right to be paid for when a book is taken out of theirs, is taken out of the library. So if a book of mine, like Girl with a Pearl Earring, if you take it out of the library, I get 6.29 pence per loan. So if it's taken out 100 times, then I get £6.29 and can go out to lunch on that.
And so is this important for writers, this fee that they get from having their books lent out?
It's very important. You know, the average wage for a writer these days is about £4,000 a year. There are a lot of writers who are making very, very little. And this is just that little extra bit of money that goes into their pocket so that they can keep going. It's not always a lot. Some people make just a couple of pounds, but quite a few writers, I think 250 writers this year, made the ceiling because it's capped. You can make up to £6,600. And that's really helpful. And that money, it doesn't always just go to the obvious people like J.K. Rowling and people who are already selling a lot of books, but also to writers who have a long backlist, like, say, a children's writer who's been writing for 30 years and has, say, 50 picture books out. Those clock up after a while.
And so, obviously, libraries are important to you as a writer from sort of the bottom end, I suppose you might say, you know, the the fact that you get paid money for people borrowing your books. What about as a writer, as somebody using a library, as a library user?
Well, I've used a library all my life. When I was a kid, we didn't buy books at bookstores. We got them out of the library. Mrs. Carney was the children's librarian, and she was really great at... She knew that I loved Laura Ingalls Wilder, Little House in the Big Woods and Little House on the Prairie. Forget the TV series. The books are fantastic. And she introduced me also to the Freddy the Pig books. These are American books. I grew up in Washington, D.C., and they were about these animals in a farmyard who all could talk and do things. And they were really wonderful, set in the 30s. And I don't think they have them over here, but I loved them. And Mrs. Carney always sort of knew when I was old enough to take on more complex ideas and, you know, maybe even have a little romance could be thrown in. So she would carefully kind of guide my reading life, and I really owe a lot to her. So libraries were important to me as a child and then as a student, of course. And then in my 20s, when I was a reference book editor, I actually edited books that were primarily went on library shelves, which are encyclopedias about writers and artists. And I had to do a lot of research in libraries for them. And in fact, I remember really well being in Swiss Cottage Library in the 90s as a freelance editor writing. I was editing this book called Encyclopedia of the Essay, and I spent hours and hours in here and at the British Library.
So how much do you think libraries have changed since you were going to libraries as a child and you know, having a personal relationship with a librarian? Is that still possible these days?
It's harder. It's not impossible, but I think people use them for different reasons. In the 2000s, the space available for books, the stacks got smaller and smaller, and the space for computers got bigger and bigger. And now, because there's free internet access in libraries, people come there a lot to use that. And the fact is, it reflects our changing way of getting information. So I think it's possibly become a little bit more impersonal. But, you know, having said that, there are still a lot of books taken out. Last year, in 2008, 2009, 314 million books were taken out. That is a lot of loans. So people are still reading a lot.
So we're in Swiss Cottage Library, where you've worked as a writer, presumably in the past. And do you know if they've got your books on the shelves?
I have no idea. I suppose we could go have a little look. We're at the F's here,
yes. So let's just wander
around.
The thing is, if they're on the shelves, I'm thinking, why hasn't anybody taken them out? And then if they're not there, I think, how come they don't have them?
Yep, I see one.
There we go.
Yep, here we go. We have Girl with a Pearl Earring. And hardback, but you know, the thing is, you can look at the it's been taken out. Look,
yeah.
They've had to put in a new
an extra
thing.
Card.
They've had to put in, look at all those loans
from going back to 2005.
Yeah, I'd say this has been loaned out, I don't know, 60 times, so maybe I've made £3.60 from this book. Books should not be, they should be available to anyone. You shouldn't have to only be able to read books if you can pay for them. I think it's a wonderful thing. It's a very civilized thing to have a library. On the other hand, for writers, it's very difficult because once a book is loaned out, people don't buy them. They borrow them. And so there's no income coming in for writers. And that's why the PLR legislation is so wonderfully affirmative for writers, because it is saying, actually, yes, you do need to be paid. We can't pay you much, but we can pay you a little bit. And it doesn't cost the government much. I think they put aside £7.5 million this past year and to help pay writers. And it's basically just giving us that little bit of extra cash to keep us going. So I'm just looking at our book. So I have two copies of Girl with a Pearl Earring and one copy of Burning Bright. They don't seem to have the latest novel out, Remarkable Creatures, but maybe it's been taken out. So
yes.
I'm gonna be optimistic about that. They took it out.
Tracy, thanks so much for coming to talk to us.
Pleasure. Thanks.
That was Tracy Chevalier. Her latest novel, Remarkable Creatures, about the redoubtable Victorian fossil hunter Mary Anning, is in a library near you. If you want to hold out for the paperback, it will be out in April from Harper. Sarah joins me now in the studio to discuss the public lending right charts with Benedicta Page of the Publisher's Bible, The Bookseller. Welcome both.
Hi.
Ben, first of all, Tracy mentioned the money that authors get, which presumably isn't going to mean much to people like James Patterson or Jacqueline Wilson.
It is capped
at £6,600. So I don't think it will mean so very much to the best-selling authors. Although, in fact, I think James Patterson doesn't qualify because he's not a British author, so I don't think he does actually
get
the money.
That's a bit of a swizz.
Well, there's a limited amount of money that's set aside for public lending right. And the reason it's capped is to make sure that there's enough for all authors to get a decent payment per loan. So it's slightly weighted towards the authors to whom it makes a greater difference, basically. And in fact, some authors waive their right to receive public lending right so that there's more money in the pot to go around among the authors who are less well-selling.
So, Sarah, what do you make of this chart?
The first thing that I thought about it was that it's particularly interesting for literary editors because we spend all of our time looking at, you know, the new big literary fiction releases, and it's all about Ian McEwan and Martin Amis and Hilary Mantel. And then you look at the public lending right chart, and these people just don't figure on it at all. They're not there. They're not within sight. I think perhaps what's interesting about it is that it shows more perhaps than the bestseller charts do, not what people's buying habits are, but what people's reading habits are. So where the bestseller chart, you're buying, you know, the new book from this year, the big new sort of Booker winner, you know, be that Wolf Hall or whatever. And these charts, it's sort of like looking at people's bookshelves and seeing what are the books that you actually pull off to read when you go to bed at night with your sort of chocolate biscuit and your cup of cocoa. You can see from this also, it gives you a sense of who the reading demographic or the library-going reading demographic is. And as we're sort of going to go on to talk about later, I think it's children and pensioners, parents and pensioners, the people who seem to be getting out the book. So it's very interesting from that point of view.
Mm. Now, there's no Stieg Larsson, for example, here, who of course, is the great revelation of this year's bestseller, last year's bestseller charts.
But again, I think you're looking at the people who have the capacity to buy books and people for whom books are very, very important, but they can't afford to go to the bookshop and, you know, be going to Waterstones and picking up the 3 for 2 offers. Because the cost of reading is so reduced by having libraries, and that's why they're so important. They're available for those sections of society, the old and young, who aren't going to be able to afford to go down and buy Stieg Larsson at the bookshop.
Mm-hmm. Ben, let's look a little bit at the literary fiction that appears there. It's quite surprising, isn't it? Sadie Jones, for example, The Outcast, that's about a boy dealing with the hypocrisy of post-World War II England. Why is that there?
The Outcast is probably one of the books that benefited from being a Richard and Judy choice. A lot of the slightly more left-field literary fiction titles that are doing well in this chart were actually choices for Richard and Judy's book club, which of course is very, very influential. Peter Hodavies, The Welsh Girl, and Rebecca Miller's The Private Lives of Pippa Lee, I think that was another choice. Victoria Hislop, The Island, Khaled Hosseini. All of these books have really benefited from the Richard and Judy, and that puts them firmly within the mainstream choices, and that's why they appear quite high on this list.
And it's interesting that there aren't any big prize winners on this list at all. So I thought maybe, well, apart from The Outcast, which I thought may be there because it won the Costa First Novel Prize, but oh no, it's only Richard and Judy.
It doesn't seem perhaps as though the prizes are benefiting them. And I think one thing that's worth saying about the PLR figures is there's very much a sense that you don't find books breaking through in the library market. It very much follows the taste that's been established elsewhere and been established through sales in bookshops, etc.
Now, you say that. Sarah, are you surprised that there's no Harry Potter on this list at all in the top 100?
Harry Potter is, it was a book-selling phenomenon as much as anything else. You assume that because everyone has bought the book, there's no real need for them to be borrowing it from libraries in kind of, you know, sort of really simple terms. And there is that difference between consumption in the buying sense and consumption in a reading sense.
I would also say that when you look at the PLR figures for the last decade, and Public Lending Right has also compiled a set of those figures, the Harry Potter titles do feature very, very high indeed. So, you know, this year as well, I think, perhaps other books are coming to the fore.
This is the year that the phenomenon finally fizzled out.
Well, it's certainly not as high, is it? But when you look at the decade figures, those books do rate very high.
Ben, crime fiction, as ever, is very dominant here. James Patterson, I think, has 13 entries, which go from number 1 to number 1997. Is crime taking over our lives? Is that all we're interested in?
Well, crime has always been one of the sort of staples of library lending. And as for James Patterson, I mean, he's practically a publishing industry in himself these days. He's extraordinarily prolific.
Seven of the titles are in conjunction with different writers. What's that about?
He's got various different series of crime thriller series for adults. He's also got series for young adults. He works with a co-writer. And, you know, it's not just a question of sort of giving it to a co-writer to do it and then slapping his name on the front. It's not like that. What he does, apparently, is he comes up with the story idea. He maps out each of the chapters, a sort of detailed synopsis of each of the chapters, sends it off to his co-writer. His co-writer does a first draft, comes back to James Patterson. He does another couple of drafts, gets it up to where he wants it to go, and out it goes. So it's very much, you know, it's a very unusual way of working. And actually, a lot of the co-writers have very much benefited from their association with James Patterson, have gone on to be very much more successful, have their profile re-raised because they've co-written with this megastar.
Ben, tell us a bit about the health of libraries in general. This is a bit of a little thrill of excitement at this time in the year, which probably isn't matched by the performance all the year round, is it?
Lending figures for children have held up very well. So that's a little bit different. But for adults, lending figures, borrowing figures are down. Every year it seems they seem to be slipping by a couple of percent here, a couple of percent there, and book spend as well. So that's rather a gloomy picture, I have to say.
Are they going to keep up with e-books?
Yes, a lot of libraries are getting very excited about ebooks, actually. And in fact, PLR doesn't cover ebooks at the moment, but there is legislation afoot to give it the right to do so, so that authors can get their 6p or whatever when their books are borrowed as ebooks. Because, yes, there is a system that quite a few libraries are signing up to. And basically, you sign onto the website of a library and you have a PIN number and you download onto your computer your ebook, and then when the loan period is up, it disappears.
Vanishes. Yes. we're not going to be writing the obituary of the public library system yet. Thank you very much, Benedicta and Sarah, for coming in. One writer who doesn't figure on the library lists, though he's twice won the Booker Prize, and indeed his novel Oscar and Lucinda was recently selected as one of the top six Booker winners of all times, is Peter Carey. He dropped into The Guardian to discuss his new novel, Parrot and Olivia in America, with Lindsay Irving, who started by asking him about his fascination with the revolutionary thinker Alexis de Tocqueville, who is the inspiration for the novel.
In the United States, he is quoted a great deal, and it's hard to find an American friend who didn't study Tocqueville in some way at school, even if they've forgotten. So Tocqueville is sort of everywhere. And what I understood from them was that here was this French aristocrat who got it, who came to the United States in 1830 and thought how wonderful American democracy was. When I read Tocqueville after this, I discovered the truth was much more complicated. He believed that there was no getting away from democracy. The revolution had occurred. He'd lost, you know, family. He'd lived with the trauma. You might wish there was not going to be a democracy in the future, but it was not going to be stopped. And one of the things he was interested in America was seeing maybe if there was a way he could find where this would be okay, if there was a place for him in history. And of course, he had this terror of the mob, the tyranny of the majority, which sounds the most horrific, reactionary sort of thought. But as I spent more time with him, I thought he was, it was not perhaps such a reactionary thought.
I wonder what sort of times, what were the political times when you started reading him in the?
Oh, yes.
Who was in charge when you in well, America well, when was, you started reading him?
It was the Gang of Thugs, of course. It was Bush and Cheney, or should I say Cheney and Bush. And by the time I'd finished it, one could look at the possibility that Palin would end up being the president of the United States once Dick Cheney. We always wanted him to die, but maybe it would not later. It would not be a good thing if she'd been the vice president. And you read Tocqueville, and you see among the many things that he was worried about that I was worried about. He's worried that somehow that because of the will of the majority, you know, a great mad moron might come to rule. And I saw time and time again the things that he was worried about were things I was worried about. Culturally, so many of us sort of despair almost daily, you know, that we're swimming in some great sea of cultural crap, and that there is, you know, important and serious culture, but for the most part, what we have made for ourselves is sort of rather like what Tocqueville was worried we would make for ourselves. In the 60s, I remember passionately believing and wanting that popular art could be great art too, and when serious people started to pay attention, say, to something like the Beatles, you know, that seemed to me like a triumph because the popular was being regarded as serious by serious people. And I was so pleased to have a short story in Australian Women's Weekly and so on. But I don't really feel that's the way it's gone.
It's not quite the utopian result you might have hoped for. But so how did this very still resonant historical figure become the fictional character? Can you tell us a bit about that? Olivier de Gaumont. He has about 17 names, but that's more or less.
I had experts on naming, standing by in Paris, who told me how to make a good Norman aristocratic name by cutting the half of this off the half of that. Anyway, I didn't want to write a history. Many excellent and more or less excellent people have done that. So there's no room for me there, and I don't do that and don't know how to do it and don't want to do that. But I was really interested in the argument, and really what I wanted to set up was this sort of argument about democracy, because Tocqueville's sort of right and he's wrong. And I wanted to have an argument between two characters who were both right and both wrong.
And so at times, if you know a little bit about Tocqueville, there, when it's really very close to the historical record.
Yes.
Indeed, I mean, his relationship with the priest who teaches him and so on is very, as far as I could tell, very precisely drawn from the history.
Oh, yes.
At other times, you cast aside all the facts. How do you go about sort of deciding what stays and what doesn't?
Well, I wanted it to work so that the people who did know about him, the historical figure, would recognize what I was doing. In the history, Tocqueville doesn't go to the United States alone. He goes with Beaumont. And it's Beaumont who writes the book about prisons and also a novel about slavery. So the thing that the historian reading it will recognize is there's a character in this book called Blackville who stands pretty much for Beaumont. And so very early in my book, Blackville is killed. So the minute you hit that point, if you're somebody who's concerned about history, you know, what the author's up to. In other words, the author is up to messing with it. Mm. If you know about Tocqueville, you will know that and you'll appreciate what I'm doing. If you don't know that, I still hope you're having your mind fed and that you're laughing a little too.
There's a character, Watkins, who produces the botanical illustrations of birds in America, which are clearly those he's produces the work of James Audubon, he has nothing to do with.
Not a single thing to do with Audubon. But the poor dead Audubon was terribly helpful, you know, in terms of what it takes to produce a portfolio of engravings in that period. So I relied on that particular bit of history.
And was a great original American artist.
Oh, absolutely. Mm.
The story kind of tells the story of both Olivier and Parrot trying to negotiate their relationship with America. And one of them, I won't give away too much, but they end up at very different points. I wonder where you've been living in the States for, 20 years now?
Mm.
Where's your relationship at with your adopted country?
I'm the author of my adopted country. I think the book represents the argument. I mean, one cannot be very settled about what it means to be. I mean, I have an American passport and I have an Australian passport. You know, I vote in elections. No, I'm politically active, but much less than I should be, and I'm continually guilty. You're living in a mad place. You're living in a very beautiful place. You're living in a place that produces seas of crap and pollution and some, you know, extraordinary art and extraordinary human beings. One lives there and is frightened by it. But if you're living in London, you should be frightened of it too. So, yeah, really the situation's not all that different. It's not a settled one. But I live in New York, and I like to live in that city. I sort of arrived there not by voting or making a political choice, but through the accidents of my personal history. You know, who knows? You know, I might be living in Kuala Lumpur just as easily, or even more easily than the United States. So I don't know. I think the argument contained by the book probably represents my feelings in total.
Peter Carey talking to Lindsay Irving. Parrot and Olivier in America is just out from Faber. Peter will be in conversation with John Mullen and the Guardian Book Club about Oscar and Lucinda, and you'll be able to get that next week along with the next episode of this podcast too. That's all for this week, however. Thanks to Tracy Chevalier, Benedicta Page, Peter Carey, Sarah Crown and Lindsay Irving. I'm Claire Armistead and the producer is Scott Corley. Goodbye.